The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
The book is about planning and property and how public planning operates in a private land market. And the contention of this right here is that the only way to think about and answer the housing question is to think about the land question in relation to the state and capital. So the book starts with sort of defining what planning is exactly and presenting a quick overview of U.S. planning history. And then I ask, why do capitalist cities plan? And that's where I'm picking up here. The history of capitalism clearly shows that market economies require planning. Despite the protestations of libertarian absolutists, markets do not emerge fully formed from a state of nature, nor are they the product of simple evolution from prior economic models. They are carefully planned, crafted, and controlled. They rely on massive legal, logistical, infrastructural, and technical capacities, all of which must not only be imagined and developed, but maintained and reproduced. They require the coercive power of militias and police, which themselves require massive amounts of planning, to accomplish such plunder and enclosure. To be sure, planning can also get in the way of markets, whether by imposing price controls or by defending public space. But if planners help the state establish spatial order over time, and if the state under capitalism is fundamentally the executive committee of the bourgeoisie, then planners, whatever their intention, are working for the maintenance, defense, and expansion of capitalism. Quite often, planners are also responsible for maintaining the spatial dimension of racial hierarchies. Within the capitalist state, planners are tasked with enforcing this racial caste through a series of supposedly race-neutral tools that are, in reality, anything but. The clearest examples are zoning and urban renewal, two policies whose formal reason for existence is to create rational and orderly urban landscapes. In reality, however, these tools are often used to target one racial group for exclusion and expulsion while clearing the way for another's quality of life. Planning itself is not inherently racist. In fact, it's central to racism's negation. But racial capitalism asks planners to sort out who will go where, under what conditions, and for whose benefit. Such actions are inherently coercive. Planners often describe the force underlying their work as police power, or the state's monopoly on legitimate violence. This power, however, is more commonly expressed through compelled consent than overt force. The built environment that planners establish is itself a means of securing consent. You don't go where you're blocked from going, whether by a road pattern, a fence, or a wall. Planners also secure consent by cloaking their power in rationality. While the capitalist state can be considered a dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, in the US context, it nonetheless operates as a republic with some democratic features. For the most part, planners cannot simply foist their plans upon the public, but must convince them that these plans are in fact the most rational option. One of the main tasks of urban planning, then, is to make capitalist development appear to be in the rational best interests of workers and bosses alike. In order for capitalist development to work, though, planners need to look out for people's survival in a way that capital will not or cannot do. The market alone will never fully meet the working class's daily needs. Wages are too low for food and have to be supplemented with welfare or direct provisions. Transportation costs are borne by the individual worker who needs mass transit to get around. Housing is perpetually beyond the means of working and poor city dwellers, thus requiring the state to offer public, subsidized, and regulated housing. While buildings and bridges are the iconic imageries of cities and planning, the hidden work of social reproduction, housing, healthcare, education, food, culture, camaraderie, is what truly allows capitalist cities to work and what most preoccupies city planners. Most of this work, production, consumption, social reproduction, takes place on land that is privately owned but publicly managed. Land is a particularly complicated factor in capitalism, as it is both a precondition for all commodities production and circulation, and a strange sort of commodity in and of itself. Land is not traded like any other product, whose value would be determined by the labor that went into its production. Instead, according to David Harvey, land is, quote, a fictitious form of capital that derives from expectations of future rents. These future rents are extremely susceptible to external factors, such as pollution, zoning, and the vagaries of demand. About 30 years ago, planning scholar Richard Fogelsong looked at these theories of land in relation to the actual history of urban planning during the first 300 years of what would become the United States. And he produced perhaps the most elegant explanation of planning's function in capitalist cities. He noticed that the central conflict in this history was between the, quote, social character of land, or its value as a collective good and a social resource, and its private ownership and control. From this conflict arose two contradictions, the property contradiction and the capitalist democracy contradiction, and it fell on professional planners to handle them. The property contradiction describes the unhappy tension between capitalist desire for certain types of planning interventions and their antipathy towards anything that restricts their operations. They need government to do several things to secure both their own profitability and the workers' survival. They demand that the state build infrastructure that makes their land usable, such as roads, train tracks, water and sewer systems. And they demand that the state care for their employees through basic welfare functions, such as emergency health care and public education, in order to ensure a reliable source of labor. Different types of capitalists, however, make different demands on the state. Industrial landholders reject environmentally strenuous zoning that restricts where in the city they can operate. Real estate capitalists would welcome such regulations because pollution diminishes their property values. Industrial capitalists might demand affordable housing for their workforce in order to stave demands for raises. Real estate capitalists would object to any constraints on their ability to maximize rental or sale prices. While capitalists in general want a lot from planners, even if they can't agree among themselves as to what exactly they want, they're also fiercely protective of their property rights. They know that private property laws are the only thing keeping their workers or tenants from expropriating them out of business, and therefore tend to be broadly suspicious of state interventions that could theoretically impinge on property rights. They know their land would be useless without planners, but they reject planning as such. This, in short, is the property contradiction. The second key phenomenon, the capitalist democracy contradiction, is born directly out of liberal government's attempts to deal with the property contradiction. In a nominally democratic capitalist republic, the state and its planners have to perform a delicate balancing act. Planners must proceed with enough openness and transparency to maintain public legitimacy, while at the same time ensuring that capital retains ultimate control over the process's parameters. The people must have their say, but their options must be limited. If the system is entirely opened up, people might demand full socialization of land, the abolition of private property, and all the rest. If the system is completely closed, however, they could revolt against unjust or unaccountable government. Planners are therefore tasked with creating public processes that are open but rigged. From this contradiction arises the familiar landscape of participatory planning, or public comment periods, community boards, planning commissions, design charrettes, and a host of other interventions. According to this model, urban planners' main job is to contain these two contradictions. Neither can be resolved, but both can be managed. This puts city planners in a complicated bind. They are encouraged to make certain land use interventions, but are prevented from making more sweeping changes. Planners operate in a system that must appear open to the public, while simultaneously guaranteeing that ultimate power resides in the hand of propertied elites. It can be a really shitty job. 30 years later, many of these contradictions are still in place. Planners still have to balance capitalist demands for interventions and fear of domination, and planners must uphold a precarious equilibrium between public participation and private control. But one key factor has changed. In the 300 years Fogelsong covers in planning the capitalist city, manufacturing capital was a serious player in municipal politics. In 1986, when the book was published, this was already less the case. Today, manufacturing capital is not a major force in most American urban cities, urban politics. Instead, most cities and towns' real estate rules. Of course, there are other strands of capital that make important claims on the city and its management. Finance continues to be a gargantuan force in New York City politics, but it is so thoroughly integrated with real estate and has been for so long that it's hardly an independent influence. Technology firms are at the heart of San Francisco's new political economy, but their vision of the city is all about private property and profitability, and in the case of Airbnb, big tech and real estate capital are one and the same. Ford and General Motors still make some cars in Detroit and Dearborn, but their presence there is largely felt through corporate headquarters and downtown real estate holdings. In the absence of any major competition, real estate dominates the neoliberal urban political economy, with mega developer Donald Trump at the helm. This is not a uniquely American phenomenon. As the global 1% reaps the majority of the world's economic growth, they have formed what one analyst calls a Niagara of capital into real estate, and shifted the bulk of their investments towards property over all other forms of economic activity. Building booms are eating up cities around the world, from London to Mumbai to Nairobi to Sao Paulo, and of course New York, where enormous, expensive, and largely uninhibited investment properties float menacingly above scenes of homelessness and deprivation. Real estate supremacy has serious consequences for the meaning and practice of urban planning. In a private land market, all planning interventions will impact land and property values, either positively or negatively. When there is an intercapitalist feud between manufacturers and developers, a number of possibilities are opened up. The presence of industry, for example, means there is a capitalist, not only a labor demand, for government-sponsored affordable housing. It also means there's a powerful constituency that values lower, not higher, land values, since industrialists tend to see land and buildings as costs rather than assets. With the decline of urban industry, as well as the real and aspirational rise of homeownership among the working and middle classes, the demand for lower land values comes only from organized renters. While urban tenant movements have secured important victories, they face a constant struggle against difficult odds. In manufacturing's absence, real estate holds something approaching monopoly power to shape the narrative around urban planning and urban futures. Under these conditions, planners managing the property contradiction are being asked to intervene in only one way, to do everything in their power to make land more expensive and to do nothing that would challenge its status as a commodity rather than a commons. Central business district transportation and park plans, great. Industrial retention and public housing, maybe not. Planners managing the capitalist democracy contradiction are facing planning commissions and review boards comprised almost entirely of people whose futures are tied to real estate. At the time of this writing, the New York City Planning Commission is made up of four members with backgrounds in commercial real estate promotion, two luxury developers, one nonprofit developer, two development consultants, a realtor, a corporate lawyer, a business improvement district president, and the building engineer behind Trump Tower. This is the real estate state, a government by developers for developers. It is not monolithic, but the parameters for planning are painfully narrow. Land is a commodity, and so is everything atop it. Property rights are sacred and should never be impinged. A healthy real estate market is the measure of a healthy city. Growth is good. In fact, growth is God. It is a horrible atmosphere for planners interested in social transformation or even social reproduction. Planners are allowed to do little but raise property values. Often they do so directly and intentionally by initiating rezonings, targeting tax breaks, or gutting protective regulations in order to stimulate development. Just as often, however, increased property values are the result of genuine socially beneficial land improvements. Public improvements become private investment opportunities as those who own the land reap the benefits of beautiful urban design and improved infrastructure. Those who cannot afford the rising rents, or in the case of homeowners, rising property assessments, are expelled. They're priced out, evicted, foreclosed, or in the best case scenario, granted one-time buyouts that will not afford them a new home in the neighborhood, let alone the city. In the real estate state, planners can do lots of nice things for rich people, but if they want to improve poor people's spaces, they risk sparking gentrification and displacement. Rich communities can lobby for all sorts of planning improvements, but many poor neighborhoods fight planning initiatives they would otherwise embrace out of a very real fear that any enhancements will trigger disinvestment. The promise of planning, of creating more beautiful cities, of imposing order on capital's chaos, of undoing exploitive relations between people and land, and between city and country, is virtually impossible to realize under these conditions. Instead, cities are increasingly faced with two options: gentrification or disinvestment. Urban planners' main job today is ensuring that the former, rather than the latter, represents their city's lot. And from there, I go on to talk more about how exactly planners enable gentrification. Then I look at Bloomberg and de Blasio, two very different mayors with very different governing coalitions who nonetheless do exactly the same thing when it comes to planning and real estate. And I say that they have this mantra when it comes to planning, which is, whatever the problem, the solution is luxury development. And I go through all these different ways that that's true. The general housing market is too expensive, so they build more luxury development and make a piece of it sort of affordable. They can't fund public housing, they put luxury development on public housing. They're worried about jobs, it's always new development, which is not just construction jobs, but increasingly the service jobs that work in them permanently afterward. Not enough transportation, so then they do like the streetcar plan in Brooklyn, Queens, or the 7-train expansion, which are both linked to real estate development. Need new parks, again, real estate, it's the High Line model or the Brooklyn Bridge Park model, where it's financed by new real estate investment. Pollution, so most new remediation projects are sponsored by the future reinvestment in real estate on that land. That's like the Gowanus model, or now the North Shore of Staten Island. Segregation, they say that the best way to desegregate neighborhoods is to gentrify them and to build in people of color neighborhoods. At the same time, they're downzoning white neighborhoods, so they prevent anyone from moving in there. Schools are struggling. They say the schools will be improved by new luxury real estate in places that have tough school environments. Increase arts funding. They're now doing that through luxury development. They put studios in them and are enlisting artists in lobbying for new rezonings. The most absurd one that I could find is preserving African burial grounds. So I'm just going to read this paragraph. In perhaps the most absurd variation on this theme, New York City is proposing a mixed-use development as a way to preserve desecrated African burial grounds. In East Harlem, a segregated 17th century Dutch cemetery for free and enslaved Africans was covered over and developed, eventually becoming a bus depot. After a groundswell of protest and planning, the city's Economic Development Corporation and the local council member proposed that a memorial be built and funded by a development that would include hundreds of apartments, a parking lot, and an office building. So in order to redress the harm caused by developing over an African burial ground, the city is now planning to develop over that same African burial ground. So whatever the problem, the solution is luxury development. Thanks.
If everyone's done with the plastic, can I just...
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I just put it in.
Okay.
So, did you decide who's next? Was it me? Or,
it
is me? Or is it Joel?
I don't care.
Let's go.
Let's go.
All right.
Yep.
I'm going to be right back.
I need to use the bathroom.
Read me back.
All right. Well, you don't get to miss this. Congratulations.
Sorry.
I suppose by way of introduction, my name's Rob Wohl. I work as a tenant organizer for a NGO in Washington, D.C. called Latino Economic Development Center. I guess I should be clear, none of this is the position of my employer, now that I've said what that is. But I'm involved in, you know, ongoing tenant struggles, and due to, like, interesting old regulations in D.C., tenants have a certain amount of control over properties that are being transferred from one owner to another. That's not the theme of my talk, but it sort of gives me, I sort of assist tenants who are trying to have their say in real estate development. And so I, from that perspective, want to raise some concerns that I have about the ways that the left has begun to approach questions of urban development. I think Sam is quite right about the dynamic that cities face of choosing between disinvestment and gentrification. So I think at this point, there's a general consensus throughout society that in major cities there's a rental housing crisis. State policy planners acknowledge this. Mainstream economists acknowledge this. You won't find anyone who disagrees with it, or with someone saying the rent is too damn high. It's a truism at this point. And the left has, you know, had to respond to this just because it's a major social concern. But we weren't really ahead of the curve. I want to say that there is a rental housing crisis that is beyond the sort of gentrification that we see in major cities like New York and Washington, D.C., though I'm going to focus on that kind of pattern. It's worth thinking about. So the left-wing position on what should happen with the housing question and questions of urban development often is a sort of like populist communitarianism. People think that the forces of capitalist development are attacking, eating up, as Sam said, a community, like a pre-existing community. The communities lose integrity and are displaced. People talk about the displacement of communities constantly.
sometimes, you know, you hear phrases like the loss and enclosure of an urban commons. That's a phrase that David Harvey uses, pretty much explicitly evoking like a model of peasant communes in medieval Europe being enclosed and people being pushed off. And then the solution that is posed in sort of theoretical terms is about the defense of the community, the empowerment of the community, self-determination and community control over land, over development. The right to the city is posed as like a collective right that people exercise to shape the kind of city that they want to live in. And I think that, well, I'll try to come back to this at the end. I see two forms of activism that are sort of legitimized by this analysis of protecting and empowering the community. One is just pure anti-development politics, like trying to stop new construction, trying to stop high-rises, trying to stop whatever is being, like people just will stop, especially high market rate rent intensifying development. Another thing you see a lot of is frequently fairly militant protests targeted at things that are seen as sort of a leading edge of a cultural transformation that changes from place to place. But in Los Angeles, there are groups protesting art galleries. In Seattle, there are groups protesting a pot shop in a historically black neighborhood. New York, I've seen protests of murals and bars, swap meets in London against cereal restaurants in DC. A friend of mine led a campaign against a food truck. I think that so far in the current wave of mass gentrification that we've seen over, depending on, you know, in Washington, DC, at least over the last 20 years, the left has done a pretty poor job of resisting it. And I think that part of the reason for that, I mean, like, the left is doing a bad job winning anything, anywhere. But I think that the way that the problem and solution and the notion of community and community control is posed as the problematic we're dealing with here can lead into certain problematic kinds of organizing. And so let me just dive into that. Yeah. So I think there are two issues. One is that there really are some actually existing organs of community control. And Sam is right to say that they are rigged, but they are contentious. There are fights in planning boards. And I deal with a lot of housing developers, market rate and affordable, and both feel extremely constrained by institutions of community voice all over the place. And in DC, those institutions are particularly powerful, in part because DC's Home Rule Charter was a product of the sort of late stage of the civil rights movement. DC got its constitutional order in the 70s, and the people who won it were a lot of like late civil rights and black power activists, and there was a flowering of fairly militant urban organizing at that period that was then sort of constitutionalized as, among other things, the city is divided into these neighborhood commissions, these elected bodies where each commissioner represents 2,000 people. So it's like very direct democracy. I mean, it's not quite direct democracy, but it is like, it's the, you know, I mean, they're not Soviets, but like they are very directly democratic, and anybody can come and like have a pretty powerful voice in them. They are Soviets of homeowners. These institutions are completely dominated by homeowners. And a thing that I have noted is that a very common job description, like, because it's not a full-time job being a neighborhood commissioner, people who get these jobs are frequently real estate agents, and they're interested in like neighborhood boosterism and property values. And the concerns these bodies take up are property values. That is not uncommon. Organized homeowner movements are very powerful all around the United States. And I think they're probably least powerful in big cities like the ones that we're discussing here. In small towns and suburbs, they are frequently the only kind of politics that exist. This kind of movement, this sort of like defensive like grassroots movements to defend homeowners' property values, are a kind of new phenomenon. There's an economist, politically I disagree with him a lot, but there's an economist, William Fischel, who has traced the rise of what he calls the home voter, this sort of mass constituency that can dominate a lot of local politics. There are a lot of different interesting explanations of where mobilized, organized homeowners who fight for the protection of their property values come from. Fischel's hypothesis is that it's a sort of legacy of the oil shock in the 70s and the attendant asset price bubble and like the sort of volatility of the economy led people to be very concerned. After that period, homes as an asset became increasingly important to the sort of economic security of homeowners. And I think that that's borne out. You know, like you've seen a decline of employer-sponsored pensions and other forms of retirement security at the same time that like home values have continued to rise. So that's an argument, that's a thing he makes. There's also sort of a legacy of like Jane Jacobs style anti-urban renewal activism. Like they really did have to be dealt with. And so like in the late 60s and in the 70s, like the HUD changed its guidelines about how community redevelopment could happen to demand more neighborhood voice. A lot of institutions are created to sort of receive the input of the community to shape how development happens. And those tend to be that it's really the homeowner show in a lot of cases. Another important thing to think about is a legacy of fair housing and desegregation and a reaction against desegregation. Homeowner movements became much more socially significant immediately in the aftermath of the passage of the Fair Housing Act and the banning of formal segregation. And at that point, homeowners became much more mobilized to fight any new development in their neighborhoods. That new development would have to be at least formally desegregated. And people are especially mobilized against, like homeowners, not people in general, but homeowners are intensely mobilized against any kind of social housing or homeless shelters or services that might bring in the poor. In DC, there's an apocryphal story that I think is actually not true, that the homeowners of Georgetown fought the expansion of the metro into their neighborhood and were against any kind of public transit infrastructure because that would allow the poor, the working class black majority of the city to come be near them. Fishel notes that New Jersey and Massachusetts, two states that have long had sort of inclusive development laws on the books that require certain, like that sort of were inclusionary zoning avant la lettre, like had required some nominal inclusion of like sort of lower and below market units in market rate development. Those states have the most local control over how development happens. So like the state imposes rules about inclusive development. Municipalities have a very democratized form of dealing with development. And you can see that as a reaction. So the outcomes of homeowner movements are largely a preserve segregation. Like there's no way around that. Homeowners are interested in preserving the value of their home, and segregated white neighborhoods have higher property values. It's rational to do that from the perspective of homeowners. Homeowners are also a very important grassroots constituency for the new right. I think that needs to be taken seriously. The best thing you could possibly read about this phenomenon, I think, is the third chapter of Mike Davis's City of Quartz. There's a chapter about homeowner associations in Los Angeles. It's very interesting. I won't go into all of it, but it's about sort of the passage of slow growth, growth-limiting legislation in LA in the 70s. There's this sort of network of homeowner associations and neighborhood and civic associations that are dominated by homeowners that fought for limitations on real estate development. Those groups that were kind of knit together around three issues, one of which was slow growth. The other two were opposition to busing and Proposition 13, the limitation on property taxes that has really gotten in the way of social reproduction in the state of California. So those constituencies were important. That specific network of Southern California homeowners was very important to specific new right politicians, Reagan, Pete Wilson. These people get support from this. So like it's really there's a direct translation from these sort of like community like this these movements that are trying to express some kind of community control. Finally, homeowners are just well positioned to dominate any kind of directly democratic organization. Homeowners are noted to vote more than tenants for lots of reasons. They're better educated, they're wealthier, they're older. They also have a clear, well-articulated interest in their property values, and they're organized due to like these historic movements in lots of places. So I am concerned that in a lot of cases, leftists get caught up in these, in like sort of anti-development struggles, hoping to protect low-income areas from being eaten up by development and then end up tailing a sort of reactionary form of anti-development politics. I see this play out in DC. I'm not going to give the details right now because I do also want to talk about the politics of tenants. And I'm real late. So I'm just worried that we get mixed up with the wrong crowd. Tenants, I think it's also I think there are lots of ways in which it's difficult to organize tenants into a movement of community control and the protection of the integration, like the integrity of a community against gentrification. It's hard to get people organized to oppose gentrification as a social process. Obviously, people don't want to be displaced, and they want to fight their own displacement, and they want to fight the displacement of their friends and family and people, and like people they perceive to be like important, you know, that they see as like of having common interests. Mm-hmm. In some circumstances, but I don't think that tenants are necessarily anti-exclusion, anti-segregation across the board. Gentrifying neighborhoods, by definition, are neighborhoods that have experienced a historic disinvestment and neglect. That's why they're gentrifying, because a rent gap has opened up, if we want to quote Neil Smith, and then there's a process where it is sort of like catching up to the potential rents. Rising rents in many cases, as Sam was saying, it is never purely speculative. There are rising rents are capitalizing real improving quality of life in many cases. If you trace where development is happening in DC, like rising property values, it follows the new metro stations. DC built the Green Line through the mid-city in the 90s, and then the neighborhoods in which Green Line metro stations opened up are the places that have experienced the most intense gentrification. If people know DC, that means Shaw, U Street, Columbia Heights, Petworth, and now Fort Totten. If you don't know DC, sorry about the gobbledygook. So gentrification entails real improvement in terms of access to jobs. And with economic development come practical benefits. The police start to deal with petty and violent crime more. And this is a significant concern for people that I talk to. Anytime I talk to someone in general terms in a gentrified neighborhood, how do you feel about the way the neighborhood has changed? Safety will inevitably come up. But there are other things too. Schools tend to improve as neighborhoods are not entirely, there is an extent to which there's a period during gentrification where desegregation does occur. And so that means that there are more privileged constituencies for investing in the public goods of formerly neglected neighborhoods. So tenants are interested in bringing more of that along. I'm sorry, I'm at 15 minutes now. Do you mind if I finish? Can I take like 3 or 4 more minutes? All right, yeah. So tenants also have decent reasons to favor exclusionary policies. Tenants are frequently for one thing, I think it's important to recognize how displacement and the threat of displacement is not only in places that are gentrifying. I think there's some interesting research that's come out that's like very controversial, like the research of Lance Freeman, which I think gets mobilized to make very bad arguments about gentrification is a myth. But Lance Freeman is a sociologist who found that rates of involuntary displacement do not appear to be that much higher in gentrifying areas than in poor areas that aren't gentrifying. And that makes an intuitive amount of sense if you consider who gets displaced as poor people. If you lose your job, you can be displaced. If your building is neglected and falls into a condition that's uninhabitable, you get displaced. And if rent rises, you get displaced. But rent can also rise in places in like the areas that continue to be neglected and poor across the board. So tenants, if they feel like they have some prospect of hanging on, of like avoiding displacement, which you can do through a lot of different individualistic strategies, and in a place like New York or DC, there are some tenants' rights policies, like affordable housing exists, there's rent control, there are just cause eviction ordinances. These are characteristics of most cities that are gentrifying the most. It means that tenants can hope, they have some reasonable hopes of being to hang on in the place they're in, even as neighborhoods gentrify. If that's the case, there's an emergent politics of exclusion, because what's happening in gentrifying neighborhoods is that in poor neighborhoods, in places that do not gentrify, poor people get displaced and are replaced by poor people. In gentrifying neighborhoods, poor people are displaced and replaced by rich, whiter, more educated people. The there are, if you are an incumbent tenant who manages to hang on, and like seeing that exclusionary process happen can improve your quality of life in a lot of ways. A friend of mine, Amanda Huron, who's a geographer who studies DC, found that she did interviews with people who'd formed housing co-ops. And the reasons people had formed housing co-ops, she categorized in three things. Trying to limit their housing costs, obviously. Trying to like take some degree of control of the building, also somewhat obvious. The third one was exclusion. And the third was, like, she found that people want to be able to keep problematic neighbors out of their buildings. They want to be able to evict drug dealers. They want to make sure that homeless people don't come and sleep in the laundry room. Like, I am a server. I work with some housing co-ops. You know, I go in to like organize their board meetings, and they evict people a lot for breaking the house rules. And tenant leaders organizing in their buildings frequently demand that landlords like evict the junkies, you know, like evict the people who are like fighting and drinking in the hallways and who like let people into the building without authorization from their neighbors. So I think we need to take that seriously, because I think it means that it's hard to articulate a politics of like preserving the community at the level, at like a sort of political level. So I think that there are alternatives to this. I think it has to do a lot with just directly confronting the things that are directly displacing people, instead of trying to like put tenants in a position to shape the capitalist development process. Like, there needs to sort of be just a direct confrontation with the forces that are pushing people out of their homes. And that doesn't necessarily take the form of like trying to take formal political power, trying to like control how development happens, but just to like fight landlords. And I think it's interesting that so little left-wing housing organizing that's occurring right now takes the form of just fighting landlords to stop rent increases, to stop evictions, to improve housing conditions. I know that there is some of that. I do some of it. I hope we'll hear some of that today. But I think it's a missing piece from a lot of people who will neglect that sort of thing in favor of protesting art galleries, which is like a questionable strategic choice from my perspective. I was going to say some stuff about Engels, but I'm going to drop that. I'm way over time.
Could always come back to Engels in the Q&A. Right. So next we'll have Joel.
Or you go.
Okay, sure. My name's Joel Feingold. I'm a co-founding member of the Crown Heights Tenant Union. Thanks for having us. So I guess I'll pick up where Rob left off. Mm-hmm. You know, the Crown Heights Tenant Union's analysis has been that landlords are exploiting a cycle of displacement and overcharge, where they will displace long-term Black and working-class tenants, West Indian tenants, frequently in Crown Heights, and then illegally overcharge new tenants. Mm-hmm. And so we saw a chance to directly confront landlords with demands for lowered rents, for an end to the displacement and overcharge. And one thing that was very significant for us was that this was a solidarity model that could really overcome the sort of cultural battles of newcomers, white newcomers, versus long-term Black tenants. We used a class analysis to do this, to say we're vis-a-vis the landlord, we are the same class. We are all tenants. And we can unite and fight on that basis. We also acknowledge, of course, that long-term Black and working class tenants, when they're displaced, it's not the same social process, it's not the same level of trauma or even of capital loss that exists for new tenants who are illegally overcharged. But because these problems emerge from the same structural position, the landlord, we see that there's an opportunity for tenants to unite and fight against the landlord. Our model is to use direct action to target landlords directly. We'll picket their houses, we'll picket their offices, we'll escalate to rent strike, and to demand collective bargaining agreements to win new rights at the building level. So one of our core demands is a 5-year rent freeze in all the buildings that we're fighting for. Another is to prevent landlords from being able to add on the cost of renovations to apartments. Very reformist demands. Mm-hmm. But the goal ultimately is to expropriate the landlords in one way or another, is to abolish landlord rule. So one of the ways that we've seen this in a very particular way or a specific way is to try to strip away from landlords the right to choose what that goes in their storefronts, which is a way of bridging the sort of cultural battles, Rob, that you're mm-hmm. talking about with the tenant power battles at the building level. So in one of the buildings where we've been organized for the longest, 1045 Union Street, tenants there were confronting a landlord for several years that refused to take rent and then a year later knocked on all their doors and said, I'm buying you all out, you all owe me $15,000, I'm offering you $15,000, leave tomorrow. So it's a sort of forced buyout. So they were, so they're confronting things like this, refused repairs for long-term black tenants, new tenants living in apartments that have been subdivided several times, and who are paying $4,000 when the last tenant was paying $800. So the goal, of course, of the landlord is to drive up rents and to make, you know, the neighborhood and ultimately the city the realm exclusively of the rich, to totally, you know, to make it a bourgeois landscape across the board. For the first time in human history, that workers would have to, that the city wouldn't be a predominantly working class space. That's the goal, ultimately, of these landlords. So what we see at the building level are processes like this, and especially at the ground level, you'll see, at the case of 1045 Union, the expulsion of long-term petty bourgeois establishments, Panamanian delis, hair braiding, African hair braiding establishments that are, really serve the neighborhood, which is not to say that there's no exploitation that goes on there within those establishments. Obviously, they're super exploitative in a lot of instances, but people feel connected to them, and they do serve needs that that people have in the neighborhood. So the Panamanian Deli at 1045 Union is evicted, and we made a demand that the tenants who lived above it, made the demand that we want community control or tenant control over what goes into that space. So the tenants there waged a very long-term campaign against a bar called Crow Bar, which was very racistly named. And we saw the racist name as an extension of the structural racism of what was happening in the neighborhood, of the displacement of the long-term black and working class community. So it wasn't just a symbolic battle, it was also a battle over space and over power in the building. So far we forced the name off of the bar, but that's not enough. We're continuing to escalate the fight to evict that bar and to hold on to that building, where tenants will ultimately hopefully win reduced rents, which we've seen in some buildings in Crown Heights. So that's the, that's sort of our model. We sort of extrapolating from this and from Sam's idea of the real estate state, we need to think about the position of tenants in this phase of capitalist development, in this sort of sub-era of capitalism, if we accept the contention that this is the real estate state, that real estate is the dominant stratum of capital in the bourgeois state right now. That means that tenants are uniquely positioned to be a major leading element of the revolutionary class, the working class. And New York, being a place where there's been literally centuries of tenant organizing, is a front line in that battle without question. So I want to talk about the ways in which Trump and the Trump regime could have only emerged from real estate capital in New York. All of the features of this regime have emerged over three generations of shitty slumlords in New York City. The most racist element of the ruling class has been New York landlords, because they see tenants of color as drains on their property value, because they have this notion of uprooting people as a means to control value. And we see this. So a really clear example is at that level of tactics. In a building that's joined the Crown Heights Tenant Union, 80 New York Avenue, 3 years ago, well before Trumpism seemed possible, the landlord there, Gold Management, hired a goon squad to dress up as ICE agents and run through the building, and threatened to evict all the M&E tenants. And so they left in fear. That's how half the building was vacated. Now, the landlord has refused heat for two consecutive winters to the long-term black tenants who remained, and to the white tenants has put in suburban style central heating in those units, but those units are now $4,500, uh-huh. And he's starting to rent them out SRO style, bedroom by bedroom. So, and interestingly, if you guys, if you follow Left Book, or if you follow anything, Kate Aronoff, the journalist, lives in this building. So the left-wing journalist lives in this building. This is an interesting coalition that's developed at 80 New York Avenue. They have this total class analysis where they see that the long-term tenants are being really ruthlessly denied services that new tenants have, but at the same time, the long-term tenants are saying, we've got to unite and fight with these neighbors who are being illegally overcharged while we want to remain front and center in the decision-making. So this is going to be, we're going to be escalating to our first really serious rent strike at 80 New York Avenue coming this May and June. And you know, we hope that this can be an example for the rest of the city and for the rest of, you know, the tenant class and the working class about how to confront this real estate state. That you have to really directly confront the capital that's destroying your life, and that becomes the basis for a politics of the future, I think. So I'll leave it there.
Well, thanks everybody. This is like fucking really dope so far. My name's Elliot Ochino. I work with Take Back the Bronx in the Bronx, and we help run a spot called the Bronx Social Center. It was going to be me and Lisa, the two folks from the Bronx today. She couldn't come, so we got a chance to brainstorm a little bit beforehand. I'll have to shake this up a bit because they actually covered some good things already. We have much less experience than what's going on in Crown Heights with tenant organizing. We've been doing different sorts of mostly anti-police and then kind of truce work among different crews of kids in the Bronx for the last few years. But then it's sort of over the course of, on the one hand, the Jerome Ave rezoning, and then now the very like initial stages of rezoning in Southern Boulevard. So there's two rezonings happening in the Bronx under the umbrella of de Blasio's housing plan that we've been trying to figure out how to intervene and then how to knit together the relationships and political discussions that are going on in those two different areas of the Bronx and the different kind of political forces that are mobilizing, which range from sort of large left nonprofits to lots of little left collectives, things like that. As Lisa and I were brainstorming on the phone before coming here, we were thinking a lot about the issues. What are the contradictions that emerge within, we didn't use this language necessarily, but it's like, what are the contradictions that emerge within the coalition or constituencies that kind of organically form in these kind of fights? Mm-hmm. How can they be overcome? What are some of the main ones? The already in what's been said, we've hit on most of them. The two that Lisa wanted to add in particular were, on the one hand, the role of nonprofits, that locally it's often the only organizational vehicle that exists to mobilize against, say, to do some sort of contestation in the like planning review meetings and that kind of thing. In some cases, it's the only networks through which you'll even hear about that process starting. You wouldn't even know about it otherwise, unless you went to the community board. But on the other hand, they have their own sort of sectional interest in shaping the way that development happens in the city, which could be different than that of low-income tenants. So at least as I understand some of the debates in the city right now, it's like the nonprofit developers are mad because they're asked out in the, is this right?
Yep.
De Blasio housing plan. So they're like, how come your tax subsidies only let us do repairs on buildings? We want to build our own buildings so that we have our own like, large stock of fixed capital, just like the private developers. You know? Mm-hmm. So obviously that doesn't matter so much when the initial mobilization with the city planner happens, but it matters down the road. And it also matters in terms of the political discourse mm-hmm. that develops and what's the meaning of the struggle that's going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one. And the other that was really salient for Lisa, especially in her building that she was organizing on Southern, was the divide between the all low-income tenants, but on the one hand, tenants who are paying entirely out of pocket, and on the other hand, the tenants that are having their rent subsidized by some sort of government program, which has sort of resentments either way on either side. But in part, that's like the past victory of class struggles have allowed the state to fuck with the reproduction of different sectors of the class to screw up the class composition, mm-hmm. you know? So they're experienced and lived as different class sectors, even though you're in very much the same situation with the fucking lights going out and the elevator not working, right. you know? But what you can anticipate in terms of your stability a year from now, or what political agencies your fight, you know, for your tenant fight winds up running into, actually diverge and pull you in separate directions. So those were two that have been, I guess, salient for us in what we've seen unfold. So I guess we didn't really have great answers. One that we thought at least it's useful to clarify the questions. That one is that it seems like no matter what, when it's kind of a truism, when any mass struggle breaks out, the true as well of tenant struggles. Any sets of demands or claims to a pre-existing community are always implicitly efforts to kind of usher it into being. It doesn't mean that it actually exists. It means that on the basis of something that exists in a mutilated and contradictory form, you're projecting forward some change in that thing. Mm-hmm. And that's usually pivoting around some sort of demand, and that demand is both framing the enemy and framing yourself in some kind of way. So it's what sorts of demands with what sort of projected identity of yourself and the class enemy allow us to, on the one hand, recompose us, and on the other hand, decompose the enemy. Like, to break apart their political consensus, and if the demands are met, break apart their, you know, actually ability to reproduce themselves and their institutions. For us, we found it useful to float, even with the problems and issues that you all have brought up, in both Jerome Avenue and the Southern Boulevard meeting. All the discourse is still within the bounds of the de Blasio housing plan. So it's like, I can't tell you how many fucking times there's been the same goddamn argument about the area median income calculated, right? And if only we could calculate it right, or impose different goddamn brackets on the goddamn... So it seems like it's necessary and useful to put out some sort of far-reaching vision, which for us is like, let's demand popular control of land and housing, even though the popular that would control it isn't really fucking clear.
Right.
You know, how that would come about is very, very hazy. But you need something that links a sort of long-term horizon and trajectory with the immediate struggles, and at least posing it in terms of popular control over land and housing or something implies like the expropriation of the people that own the buildings currently. And that discourse forces the homeowners who are in the room to consider what their place in that, like, vision might be. Mm-hmm. You know? And it's a bit different mm-hmm. than democratic, like, really democratic community boards mm-hmm. With like a better tax policy. Mm-hmm. So these are just our thoughts. I have one question that I'll save for the discussion, but a lot was actually covered already, so I just look forward to discussion and kicking it around a bit. Thanks.
Great. So we have
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.